Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Nicole Quinn, and I'm here with Dr. Daylon James, co-host of the Stem Cell Podcast. Welcome to the Lab Coats and Life Podcast, where we help scientists thrive. The Lab Coats and Life Podcast is brought to you by Stem Cell Technologies, a global biotechnology company supporting life sciences research and fostering communication and collaboration in science. If you enjoy the Lab Coats and Life Podcast, rate us and leave us a review. You can also suggest ideas or recommend guests for new episodes. Today's episode is titled From Mentee to Mentor, How to Help Trainees Thrive, and we have Dr. Nika Shakiba joining us. Dr. Shakiba is an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. She completed her postdoctoral training with Dr. Ron Weiss and Dr. Domitella Del Vecchio's labs in the Department of Biological Engineering at MIT, and her doctoral training in Dr. Peter Zanstra's Stem Cell Bioengineering Lab at the University of Toronto. Her group applies systems and synthetic biology principles to engineer stem cell behavior. Nika has a passion for outreach and mentorship, and she is co-founder of the Advice to Scientists initiative. But before we get to that, are you enjoying listening to the Lab Coats and Life podcast? Are there other soft skills, topics, or questions about your life in a lab coat that you'd like to learn more about? Visit www.stemcell.com/suggest-topics to tell us what you're passionate about, and we will endeavor to cover it via Stem Cell Technologies mentorship resources. If you fill in the Suggest a Topic form before the end of August, you'll be entered into our latest Lab Coats and Life lab coat giveaway. That's www.stemcell.com/suggest-topics. Okay, Nika, welcome to Lab Coats and Life. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Daylon, how is everything over in New York?
It's great. And, you know, it's so nice to actually be in the passenger seat on a podcast for once, Nicole. And I'm handing it off to you. You're doing a great job. I can't wait to have this conversation.
I'm here with a pro. Okay, we're just going to kick off some questions. But before we get too deep, I would love you to introduce yourself, Nika. Give us an overview. I gave a bit of a background of your academic training, but I'd love to hear more about your mentorship initiatives and sort of where you're sitting now.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I'm an assistant professor here at UBC in Vancouver. And I think my training was very much of a discovery process. I don't think I went in with a plan in particular. And along the way, I was really reliant on mentors, whether that was peer mentors or whether that was, you know, supervisors or people who were ahead of me in their career. And it was largely serendipitous. I think I just got lucky to be around really amazing people that became invested in me and empowered me. And so I've always been fascinated with that and wanted to kind of pay that forward. And early on, I did that a lot through scientific outreach initiatives. So I was involved with like the Da Vinci Engineering Enrichment Program, which was like a fun high school program in the summer, brought students in from around the country and kind of exposed them to different kinds of engineering. And then I, you know, started to get involved with other outreach initiatives like stem cell talks. And then I guess it kind of grew. And when I became a postdoc, one of my co-supervisors, Ron Weiss, and I co-founded Advice to a Scientist, which can be found at advicetoascientist.com. And the whole idea was to try to take some of the serendipity and the luck elements out of finding mentors and finding advice along your career trajectory, and to really promote kind of multi-directional advice exchange. I don't think I've really graduated to a mentor. I'm still a mentee. I don't think we ever graduate to mentor status. We just kind of get more opportunities to mentor, but we're always still mentees.
Yeah, hats off to you, because most of us, you know, we get out of our training phase and we're just trying to survive. So, I mean, it really, I think you deserve a lot of respect and applause for leading with the mentorship. You know, most people, it takes them establishing their own careers and, you know, being, I don't want to say ready, because I think you're always ready to mentor, but being comfortable, I'd say. And I think it really, it's a new trend, I hope, that, you know, you lead with mentorship, because, you know, since there's been any craft or any application of expertise, there's been mentorship, you know, thousands of years now. But the modus has changed a lot, and the externalities and extrinsic forces on the mentorship process have perhaps become more complicated. So I have to ask you, in your experience, how has mentorship changed as the job landscape has changed in science? I mean, more recently, and particularly in our field, industry's booming. And secondarily, how do you come right out of your training and into mentorship? You know, it's like a job that you've never really had. You just assumed. So a couple of things there. How has it changed and how do you do it?
Yeah, maybe I'll start with the how do I do it part first, because I think it's an easier one to answer. To be honest, I don't think I'm like super qualified to be a mentor. And it's not altruistic. It's so self-serving because it's one of the aspects of my job that gives me a kind of immediate positive reward. Much of the science and much of the grant writing and all the other things that we have to do in this job requires patience and is a low luck or low probability of success endeavor. Whereas, you know, the people you interact with and those opportunities for positive impact are there every day. And by taking them, you kind of, it keeps me motivated. Like I see those positive rewards anytime I get like a random message from one of my former undergraduate students, like it just happened to me this week, who had found another one of my former undergraduate students, who are both now graduate students at Stanford. And they just kind of like ran into each other and they were like, oh, we both have worked with Nika. And then they snapped me a selfie and they sent it back. Those kinds of moments are so fueling. Then I can sit here and look at my grant that is like probably like miserably coming together and be like renewed and want to do it. So it's super self-serving. It keeps my energy high.
Nika, if I can interject, I'll just give you another little boost. When we asked around Stem Cell, who should we talk to about mentorship out there, several people mentioned your name. So you've obviously had a very, very broad influence. You know, Vancouver's a small place, but yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate it. No, and it's an opportunity. It's a privilege to do it, right? And it really does impact me positively. So, but maybe going back to your other question about like, how is the landscape of mentorship changed? I think it's just made it more obvious that diversifying mentorship is an essential part of the endeavor. It's a really hard ask to have a mentor or two mentors that you go to for absolutely everything. They cannot know, right, all the best moves to be making for different kinds of careers or in different circumstances. And so you really should be diversifying mentors and embrace peer mentors. I can't tell you how many of my peers who, you know, I knew in my undergrad or in my graduate studies or in postdocs are now like starting their own companies, freelancing, like doing such cool things that I never could have imagined. And they are great resources for inspiration, but also for advice and, you know, growing your own network. So I think it's that aspect of like needing to diversify.
I think that leads us really well into the next question here, which is, we all know that scientific knowledge is, you know, the primary thing, the deep expertise in some given field is the obvious area you're going to mentor somebody in as a professor. But there's other skills, other things that we want our students to come out with. I say we, I'm not in that role, but I definitely play a mentorship role here at Stem Cell. What are some of those skills beyond just knowing the science that you really look for and try to hone?
Yeah, I think my students will laugh if I say this word because they're gonna be like, I knew you'd say this, but scientific storytelling is one of the biggest things that I'm really hoping my students would embrace and become super proficient in by the time they leave. I always tell them like 50% of the endeavor is actually doing the science and 50% is figuring out how to present it, how to describe its importance and position it within the context of the field and to share it with the world. Like that is a huge endeavor and you can't kind of just leave it as an afterthought in your scientific process. It's like the same concept of like if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, did it happen? Like if you did an experiment and no one knows about it or can't understand what you did or why, like, was it important? Did it have an impact? And so we talk a lot about scientific storytelling. And other things that we like to think about are more around, I think, confidence. Like there's a certain element of self-confidence that needs to be acquired. And it's really challenging to do, especially as a graduate student, because you're thrown into this world of uncertainty. Like there's no ABC to completing a degree, right? It's a nonlinear path that you are charting for yourself. And so there's a certain element of kind of resilience and self-confidence that needs to be built up and does get built up along the way, because you realize, like, I can do this, right? And I have the support of people around me to do it, that I'm really hoping my students acquire.
I echo those. I think that telling a story, I mean, I love to tell a story. I'm up here doing this podcast, telling other people's stories, and it's the joy of my life. So I echo that absolutely. And yeah, to piggyback on that second idea of resilience, is teaching, I don't want to say teaching how to fail, but teaching how to move on, you know, how to take a kind of a scattershot approach and have a few buns in the oven, because nothing's ever going to come out right the first time, rarely going to come out first time. And it can be really demoralizing. And I think a lot of that gets washed away, you know, as a young PI or even a young postdoc trainee at any phase, that you get over that, you get inured to that failure on some level. But I think that it's not impressed enough upon the trainees that that's baked in, right? And all the technical things, hypothesis formation, studying design and asking the right questions and controls, that can be really technical and I think taught. But I think what really has to come from within, and what I think trainees need a lot of support with, is that, okay, so what's next? Okay, so what's next? And you got to do that, you know, 10, 20 times in your career, at least, before you really get, you know, your arms wrapped around a tough question that has a deep well of science to unpack. And I think a lot of people in science can get really caught up because of all the extrinsic forces about success and achievement. And you've been here 4 years, what about your ACE or whatever it may be? You know, I think there's not enough room, I think, nowadays for failure, because it's there for so many people to see. Back in the ivory tower days, people were failing a million times. No one had to know. Thomas Edison, 10,000 ways, right? No one was staring down his, you know, looking at him, asking for his funding renewals and et cetera. So I just think we need to bake it in. You're not gonna win the first few times. So that's what I think I would like to impress from the first day.
Yeah. And honestly, if you're not failing, like, you're probably doing it wrong. You're probably picking questions that are too easy, or, you know, like, go bigger.
Exactly. I mean, and that said, you got to have the safety. I think as a mentor, you got to build that into, especially younger trainees, is that they got to have something solid. And that comes with the study design, where the answer, positive or negative, is going to have value. I think that's what you can teach. But also, you got to encourage them to swing big and maybe fail. And that brings me to the next question to you, Nika. I mean, talking more on the trainee level, we're talking about graduate students. I think you probably have a lot of experience and had a lot of influence, and you're loved not for no reason, because you do a good job and you make them feel welcome and supported. But what are the core fundamental skills you nurture in a trainee at that level that you need them to demonstrate before you'll recommend them for graduation? You know, what's the key to taking that first dive into the next stage, I guess, as an independent scientist in your postdoc?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I mean, I do my best to be the supportive PI, but nobody's perfect. There's failures there too. So I'm totally happy to acknowledge that. I think for me, it's a combination of things, but what my expectations tend to shift with the goals of the individual. So if that person wants to do a postdoc, that kind of have different goals and expectations in my mind than someone who's interested in a different career trajectory. And so, for example, I have students that are, like, very entrepreneurial, really interested in kind of joining a startup or having their own startup. And, you know, the goals for those students are really to get them business savvy, you know, give them experiences. You know, I'm not an expert in that realm, but give them experiences where they can gain expertise that will serve them well. For people who want to stay in the academic route, or at least want to do a postdoc, right? The things that I would expect to see are probably different. There's you know, probably key properties of scientists that we maybe can all agree on, like, you know, detail orientedness, and someone who's keeping good notes and kind of keeping their eye on all the variables that could be possibly affecting their results, so that reproducibility of what they're doing is high. Someone who can present their work clearly for a scientific audience in particular, and can kind of plan ahead on experiments, but also have backup plans, right? If things go wrong. So I think it really depends on the student, but there probably is common denominators for everybody, right? That we would want to see. But I've only graduated one grad student, so I'm not the expert on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you allude to the fabric, right, of science, and then it's very kind of bespoke, especially now more than ever, with so many avenues for trainees at any level to take. And let me turn the question on you there, Nicole. Mentorship in a, I wouldn't even call it non-traditional anymore. I think industry is like a maybe majority alternative to academia. What does it look like for you, mentorship in that setting at Stem Cell Technologies? Would you find it's different from your experience in academia or elsewhere?
There's a lot to say there. I think mentorship in industry, the way it looks as a mentor is a bit different. There's a lot more structure around that. We have structured courses. We offer employees at all levels, but certainly employees starting off their careers. I think we have over almost 2,000 different courses on communication and project management and all kinds of stuff like that. But there's also just being a leader in business and trying to meet people where they are and help coach them throughout their careers and where they're stuck. And, you know, some people come in with stronger project management skills, and that's great. And others are stronger communication skills, and others are really good at working in teams. Others are very good at independent work. And finding those strengths and trying to accelerate them and provide opportunities that that help people thrive in those situations, but also finding areas of growth and giving feedback and helping provide opportunities for that growth is also very important. I would say what both of you said about that ability to fail and the tenacity and resilience that comes from science training is one of the biggest strengths you can bring to an industry role. I know when I started at Stem Cell almost 12 years ago, I was employee like 300 and something. And now this year we're going to hit 2,500 employees. So we grow at 20%+ per year, year on year. It's a different company every year, and you're doing a different job every year. And there are projects that come and go, and there's a lot of ambiguity and a lot of gray and a lot of kind of chaos maybe. And the ability to live and thrive in that ambiguity and to be able to invest your time and energy into a project or an initiative that may only have, you know, by the time you finish it and you're ready to launch, the environment's changed so much that it's no longer even relevant and it doesn't even get implemented. And to look at that and say, okay, I'm going to scrap it and sell it for parts and you know, what pieces of this can be salvaged and applied somewhere else, and what pieces can, you know, just need to be shelved and move on. And that resilience and grit that I think really comes from an academic background, I see that day after day after day as an asset. I know when I was training early in my master's, when I was so green and so naive and didn't know what I was doing, and I had spent a ton of time on an assay and it just didn't pan out. And I just, you know, I had my head in my hands kind of going, what, you know, 3-4 months were wasted, whatever it was. And the senior PhD student in the lab walked by and he's like, well, chalk it up to experience and move on. And like, that was so heartbreaking to hear at the time, but that's what you have to do and you have to be able to do. And like I said, when people are able to do that and really distill the chaos and move on, they tend to thrive in industry.
Yeah, part of that is just time, right? I feel like as you get older, maybe in any field, you know, 3 months for me sounds like, oh, great, that's a win. You lost 3 months, you know? I've lost 3 years on something that just didn't pan out. Big idea, but maybe a little too ambitious, and that happens. So I think part of it is just, again, you become cognizant of the risk and tolerant of it. And then you kind of focus on all the failures that you didn't have, or maybe the one failure that you didn't have.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, totally. At the time, I was like, I got to get out of this degree in 2 years. 3 months is a big chunk of that. And then looking back, it's like, that was nothing. That was nothing. We have so many, and you learn more from the failures. Of course, we all know that, but you don't know that coming in. And so I think as mentors, we have to we have to try to help our mentees understand that failure is good and you can learn from it.
One of my more senior colleagues, who's also a mentor, always describes his process. So he tends to swing big a lot, and he definitely hits big, but often misses too. And I always ask him, like, how do you deal with that? And he says that he kind of just sees, like, this whole academic process as a game. He's just like playing a video game, and, you know, you lose the levels, you replay the levels, like, it's not a big deal. And he's really quick to forget the failures, which I think is a really nice quality. Like, I'm really trying to strive for that more. And also because I really buy into the gaming analogy. I named my cats after Nintendo characters. So
amazing.
My husband's name is Mario. So the cats are all Super Mario characters. Yoshi and Pokey, who's one of the enemies.
Nice.
Well, just as we're talking about this, I think we're putting, I'll say, to have a more unvarnished view, maybe for some of the young trainees or young PIs even, we're balking at all our, fail. I mean, the reality is the pressure, I guess, is great. And I think that's one of the entitlements and privileges of being a established PI. And we all know how the demographics are skewed there, but it really is that they are afforded that privilege to fail, and they have either the funding and the reputation or the good faith of their, you know, trainees even, much less all the other people who serve to judge their science. So I think that we should be clear that we understand, and I at least, and I'm sure I speak for you too, that the stakes are really high nowadays. And that's part of the problem with science. But I guess, you know, that young phase, that green phase, as we're describing it, it's like your kids. I mean, you got to protect them so that they're able to become their best thinker, you know, not produce, you know, just do something that's in them. Let it out.
I love that.
Yeah, I do too. And I do recognize that there's a lot of nervousness when somebody, you know, enters a new job and you're like, it's okay to fail. It's okay to fail. Well, you know, we do have targets. We do have goals. We do have, you know, various milestones we have to meet. And we set those every quarter. And I've had this conversation so many times when somebody comes to me at a quarterly review and they're like, I didn't meet them all. I didn't get them all. And, you know, they feel like they're going to fail. They feel like their job's at risk. And I have to say, no, we're a growth company. We don't know what's happening quarter after quarter. If you've got most of them, we're good. You know, if you've been working hard and showing that you're dedicated to the job and you're learning, then we're good. But I do understand that there's nerves there. And I think reassurance and just having, you know, sometimes you do have to be a bit of a nurturer, a bit of a therapist for your mentees. Switching directions here, we're talking all about the success that we have sometimes, you know, as with our mentees, but sometimes it doesn't pan out. And sometimes there is a mismatch, or you know, somebody has taken the wrong step, and it's, you know, you can sort of see the writing on the wall. And how would you advise a mentor to approach a mismatch situation? And then also, how would you advise a mentee?
Yeah, I guess I like the bet hedging strategy, diversifying. I don't know. I feel like I'm an economist or something, economist at sometimes, because I say this word a lot, but like bet hedging is really good. So if you're diversifying your mentors, you're not kind of like fully reliant on this one person. If it's like your supervisor, for example, to, you know, to provide all of the support and all of the things that you need, you have a committee, but you probably also have other like organically formed mentors that you could then rely on and get what you need from them or get their advice. And I think a lot of the times the like mismatching or the misalignment can be chalked up to just misunderstanding, and learning how to empathize with that person's perspective is a growth opportunity. And I think it builds grit, like it builds a different kind of grit, but it's an important quality. It's really not advantageous to not be able to work with people, right? Even if you don't get along with them and you don't see eye to eye, it's important to at least professionally be able to work with that person. And so I think it's leaning on others to advise and then using it as an opportunity to grow your skills is kind of how I would see it.
I love that answer. Because when you get into the professional world, assuming you're training to ultimately take a paid job, you don't get to pick. You don't get to move around. I mean, yes, you can leave a job and find another job, but I guarantee you, you're going to land in that other job. And there's also going to be people who you don't jive with, you don't sit on the same wavelength with, you don't, you know, work in the same ways. And learning how to find ways to align and to move together and not create conflict, or navigate conflict at least, is absolutely essential. And if you don't have those skills, you certainly will not thrive in an industry where things move fast and you have to be able to keep up. So
absolutely. Yeah. It's also like a missed opportunity to learn from someone who sees the world maybe different than you. And I'm sure there's some validity in how they see things too, right? Nothing is ever black and white. And so learning how to remove those kind of positive essences, and learn from people.
Perspective is really key. I know when I was going through my PhD early on, I had a lot to learn. I did a PhD in molecular biology and biochemistry, and I somehow got through all of my undergraduate without taking any molecular biology or biochemistry. So I got there and had to catch up real quick. And so it was tense for a while because I was not meeting the expectations that my very, very brilliant molecular biologist PI had of me. And I didn't have the perspective that he had, which was, if I don't get you here, you're not going to get there. And so there was a lot of pressure and a lot of tears, honestly. And then now looking back, I'm so thankful he pushed me so hard, because I wouldn't have been able to get over the hurdles I needed to get over and ultimately to be able to graduate with that degree. So understanding that your mentees may not have that perspective, and understanding as a mentee that you need to build some perspective, I think is really important.
I love all those points. And I mean, just echoing them again, piggybacking, I think that taking the animus out of it, at least at the point of decision and confronting the reality, I mean, it's awkward, it's tough. You just got to try and make it as least awkward as possible. And I think key really to that is, you know, don't take it personally and don't make it personal. I've had gone my separate ways from trainees in the past. And I'll be honest, I was surprised and I was hurt. Like, I felt it. I was like, but wait, it wasn't about me. It was about this. It was like, but what about the science? Like, wait, you, it was like they were saying my idea was crap. You know what I mean? That's like what my lizard self was telling me, is like, wait, you're rejecting my science. And then, you know, cooler heads, I thought about it for literally 1 second. It was like, what am I thinking? You know, this is a human who's, you know, looking for, in this case, her best interest. And she went to industry. I've spoken with her since. I wouldn't say we're very close, but, you know, there's a mutual respect, understanding. I appreciate the fact that she made that decision. And I see it as perhaps a lapse on my part that I didn't concentrate enough on the fit. You know, I didn't see that she wasn't thriving or wasn't happy in the work. I wasn't making the point of contact. The fact that she had to come to me with this saying, I'm leaving, that hurt. And I think that was a real lesson for me. That, you know, first of all, that we're all gotta, you know, look out for ourselves. And as you were saying, Nika, hedge your bets. You know, PIs always are allowed to have, or it's assumed that they have many different postdocs for this exact reason. But the reverse isn't always true. For trainees, they have this one individual who's the custodian of their entire career. That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that, you know, we all as mentors have to do a better job looking out for our trainees. But first and foremost, we have to consider them as individuals and not take it personally when they make decisions that are in their own best interest, because, you know, you don't want someone also who's not happy.
Yep. I think that's a good segue into this question that I think is a nice roundtable topic for all of us. What is the biggest lesson as a mentor that you've had to learn again and again and again? And I'm stealing that question from Oprah Winfrey, because she always asks people, what do you have to learn again and again? Nika, do you have something off the top of your head?
I think I've been surprised, but I really shouldn't have been, at how little I know. Like, I just feel like every day I come in and it's a new challenge as a mentor, like a thing that I've never dealt with. And to be honest, it makes sense. Like, I will forever be learning because people are complicated. Science is complicated. And there's probably an infinite combination of variables that can yield different situations that we have to deal with. And so I think learning to be uncomfortable, learning to be comfortable with discomfort is the thing that I'm like constantly learning over and over again, and in different ways, both like scientifically and in like people management, financial management, all the different hats we wear in these roles. Yeah.
I love it. Daylon.
You know, besides the tech, which I have to teach myself over and over every year, and the programming and all the tools and science, I think I have to keep, well, I keep being reminded over and over that I can't do it by myself. I mean, my like natural resting state is more of an introverted one, more of a do-it-yourself type of person, self-reliance to a fault perhaps. And you know, that just can't do it in science nowadays. It doesn't make any sense. You're not gonna be productive or effective. And I think that I just have to continue to learn to recruit, you know, to recruit relationships, continue to try and gain more, not just amongst trainees, but amongst collaborators and, you know, networks. Get out there. I hate to say it, you know, going to conferences, not my favorite thing, but I'm always happy once I've done it. And I think I'm always reminded on the back end about how worthless I am as an individual scientist.
Oh, gosh. I love Daylon. He's so humble and so good at what he does. Yeah, for me, it's also a comfort thing. It's comfortable, I think, letting go and letting people come about things in their own way and understanding that I don't always know the best route to an answer. And if I sort of set a North Star for somebody, or we set a North Star together, and then I have to back up and give them some space. But then on other occasions, I can't back up too far because they need more help. And so knowing how much to help and how much to step in and when to nudge versus when to like really get into the details with somebody is tough. And it takes, I think, a built up muscle to have some instinct around that. And sometimes I think I get it right and I've given someone just enough space, and sometimes I give too much and, you know, I put somebody in a vulnerable situation because I haven't prepared them as much as maybe I should have or could have. And then other times I step in too much and I'm stepping on somebody's toes, and I don't like that either. So I just, you know, where's that balance? And it's different for every person and every individual, every situation, every job role. But I'm constantly aware of that balance.
It's amazing. I mean, that it's so bespoke, right? I mean, we're talking as though there's any kind of roadmap, but here we're all acknowledging that, like, we're pretty much figuring it out on the fly. And I don't know that that's, maybe that's just always been the case, very seat of pants. But I think part of it is that we're in a kind of shifting scientific culture, or the priorities are shifting, or the landscape. I don't want to say industry versus academia, because that's not it. That I wouldn't define it as a versus situation, but the landscape has changed. You know, the employment landscape has changed, and the whole notion, even outside of science, the idea of what it means, the relationship between an employer and employee, and what, you know, borders on exploitation, it was glorified for years. This whole idea, oh, you know, postdoc, it's the next thing to a slave. Like, you'd say a grad student, I got to get a grad student, they're free. This idea, which I think now, and it seems more and more repellent as people, you know, say it, the idea that this was just, you know, this slave labor, I hate to use the word, but I think that's what the word people used. And this idea also of, and borne out, in fact, you hear these stories about postdocs not being allowed to, you know, move on because they were too productive or too good, or their mentors sabotaging their career prospects. I mean, I can't even imagine that. And but I've heard it. But I think things are changing. I mean, I was just instructed to post a notice of election for the postdoctoral union that's formed. I don't know if that's nationwide, but at least at Weill Cornell, they've unionized. And, you know, generally, I think that we're fighting now to try and recruit talent because there's industry provides a really great opportunity to translate science and also to innovate in R&D. So I think that there's a lot more options out there for postdocs and the culture is changing, but still, you know, there's still that legacy, I think, of postdocs being underappreciated, not enough academic positions for the demand amongst postdocs. I would start with you, Nika, as mentors. What role do you think we have, or how can we best navigate, one, continuing to foster the change of the environment, and two, ensuring that even though we're in this changing environment, it's a bit dynamic, that we're still preparing trainees, as you alluded to there, with the scientific fabric, to hedge, as you've also alluded to, so that they'll be able to thrive in a culture that is perhaps a bit slow to evolve.
Yeah, I think part of it is probably keeping a finger on the beat of it all. I mean, it's so fast changing, but at least like understanding what people's perspectives and not just your own tiny little view of what academic life is like and what, you know, biotech might be like, for example, but kind of keeping a finger on the trends, like how are things changing? Why are they changing? Is this something that, you know, we want to support and help our students become a part of, or is this something that we want to resist? And there's kind of examples of both that I think have come to light. So I think part of it is just like being aware and not assuming we know everything ourselves. So I really love to kind of follow the lead of my students, because oftentimes like they've done the homework to know like, okay, you know, this is like a new field or a new like biotech sector. And I think it's like really valuable and I'd like to get involved in it. And then that's kind of how you kind of build your mentorship structure around them and align your approach with their goals and not be the one to kind of lead the goal and say, well, no, like the only worthwhile endeavor is academia, which I think was a common cultural thing for many labs. And I've been told that by some people, and, you know, they've been told by their PIs, like that's my PI's approach to it. And if I don't want to go in academia, they're not going to be very supportive. They're not going to write, you know, strong reference letters, or they're not going to step into the role of a sponsor, which I think is fundamentally different than a mentor. And so I think that is a part of it that I try, like let your trainees or let your mentees be the one to guide what's right for them and what they need, and fill in the gaps for them.
Daylon, I think you had some really great points about the treatment of graduate students and postdocs and the expectations, certainly in science, is my own experience, is you're expected to really be sacrificial. You know, everything has to go towards your studies, and you're generally very underpaid and there's no benefits and all of those things. And I'm really glad to hear that that is changing. For me, it was a huge impact for me because I was a little bit older when I started my PhD. I had a baby halfway through my PhD, which was interesting. There are no benefits for that. Not a lot of support. I had a very supportive PI and supervisory committee, but it is something that I think academia needs to continue to work on, because I know coming to industry, we have wonderful benefits, and as a result, the diversity and inclusion that can take place here. We have, you know, parents and people of all different backgrounds who have access to work at a job like this, versus in academia, if you have other responsibilities, if you have financial constraints, you can't live off of the, you know, the meager stipends that you get as a graduate student. It really limits diversity and inclusion. So I really hope that there's a lot more push for mentors.
I think that a lot of it, I think market forces are going to push it in that direction. I think it's I'm not psyched that it's a challenge to recruit great postdocs, because a lot of them are moving towards the translational facets of their science in industry, but it's great for, I think, the field as a whole. Because, you know, that whole idea that we're talking about of the factory and these massive labs, I mean, I don't want to throw shade on any of these amazing scientists and PIs that have these mega labs, but I'll say it. It facilitates an exploitative environment that, by definition, a minority of those individuals in those mega labs are going to, I think, thrive and meet the potential that they have. And I think that's inexcusable. And I think it's only facilitated by policies that allow granted, there's not an infinite amount of grant funding, but none of these PIs have enough money to be paying 30 postdocs what they're worth, right? So it's just a reality. And I don't think there's any intent behind it, but the system certainly does not benefit these individuals. And I think market forces are going to dictate that they'll have better options. And hopefully more regulatory forces will facilitate that too. I talked to a person I won't name, but who I really respect at the ISSCR. And they were telling me that this whole idea of a lab needs to undergo a massive change. It's already happening. You need to be building a family. You need to be building and making an investment in people over the long term. You know, you need to create space for them to thrive and be promoted and advance their careers and be recognized and get grants. You need to create a smaller group that has a life.
Yep.
Is that crazy? I don't think so.
I don't think so. And I think that's one of the few things that maybe at like a lab level, we have some control over as mentors, perhaps. Like, you know, we don't have to be splitting your tiny little budgets into 10 and hiring people at like really low pays. Like, we have some degree of control over shifting those pays up within like, you know, institutional rules. But that's, I think, where we can be pushing the envelope and going for smaller labs where it's like really focused on the quality of the experience for the individual and investing in the individual. And believe me, it will have returns for the science side. Like, I've seen it. So not necessarily even just in my lab, like I've seen it in other labs. It's not like an N of one experiment. So I really do think that model of kind of shifting our focus on what we're investing in and making sure that policymakers and governments understand like that is the investment. It's not the science. As sad as that might sound, like, I really don't think it's the science. I think it's the people, and the science is the byproduct. And if you do the investment right, you will get good science back, right?
That's so good. That's exactly right. We talk about the NIH budget. We talk about the projects, you know, the grants and the endpoints and specific aims. But yeah, we should be thinking more about the people that are going to make these therapies, and look what's happened. We're in the midst of it, all this stuff coming into trial. It's such an exciting time. It didn't happen because we had 40 postdocs in a room. It happened because individuals pushed the science forward.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay. What is your best advice to mentees? And this could be something that was passed on to you from one of your favorite mentors or something you've learned along the way, but maybe to wrap it up, what if you could give one little nugget to mentees, to what is the best one?
It's probably one that I didn't really follow well myself, but like try to make an informed decision. I think a lot of academia and just life in general is so luck dependent. It's so like serendipity dependent. But I think we can do some things to increase the odds of serendipitous moments, or at least to like embrace opportunities when they come. And I think part of it is like seeking more input and advice from people. So like go out and ask people like what is your job like? If you're really on this like soul searching journey of like what should I do after academia, which is one that I've been chatting to multiple people about recently, like don't just ask me. Go ask all the people, you know, around you, and maybe people that you didn't even like think that's a job or like that you could do that. What is your job about, and how do I get there, and do you advise it, and you know, like get more input so that you're making an informed decision about what you're doing and not just falling into the next step. It's kind of easy to get caught on the conveyor belt. It's difficult to move yourself off the conveyor belt, but you don't want to get to the end of the line and look back and say like, why did I do that? Like really my passion was more in like writing. Why am I doing this? So asking those kind of soul searching questions and seeking actively advice is really powerful. And it will also grow your mentor network. Like all of a sudden you'll find people that are like really interested and invested in you, and they will follow up and say like, I gave you that advice. Like, did it work out? And then you naturally grow your network, and then opportunities pop up. Like, they will think of you and be like, ah, yes, we talked about, you know, you were interested in, like, I don't know, scientific outreach. I saw this opportunity. Would you be interested in it? I've had that happen. So it's almost like catalyzing people around you to become mentors. And then even to take that step from being a mentor to being a sponsor, you're catalyzing those opportunities for yourself.
My PI used to say, the harder you work, the luckier you get. And it was really hard to hear when I was working my butt off and I didn't understand what the heck he meant. And then later on, it just sort of occurred to me that what you're saying is, the more you put yourself out there, the more you invest in it, the more those opportunities are going to come your way. So, Daylon, what's your best advice?
I shouldn't be giving anyone advice, but I'll give it a shot. I mean, I think that if I were starting all over again, at least, I would say, you know, looking at the things maybe I did right and maybe I did wrong, and I'm not going to itemize for any that are curious. I'm sorry. But I think that one thing that is important is to think about your mentor. You know, it's not like, let's say you graduate college, you're like, I'm going to work for Chase Bank. Like, I think that's a mistake. You're going to work for a bank? No, you're going to work with the people in the bank. I think that's, a lot of people think, oh, I'm going to work in, and I'm going to pick out an example. She's amazing. So she could take it. Like Elaine Fuchs, it's a great example, right? You go to work for Elaine Fuchs, that's an amazing pedigree. You know, her cell papers alone, like in her dendrogram of all her trainees now turned, you know, professors at this point, Valentina Greco, Valerie Horsley, Cedric Lampont. I mean, I couldn't count them on two hands. The imprint that she made is, you know, it speaks for itself. But I'm sure she was really, this is why she was so good, is that even though she is such a legend, that those people who joined her lab, they weren't going to work for her, they were going to work with her. I think you got to think of your mentors as your collaborators in science in particular. You got to think of this, is this a person that I want to work with? Is this a person I can sit in their office on the weekend and just talk about science with? Not only like, could I, are they smart enough? Do they have the charisma? But like, are they going to have the time for that? And, you know, case by case, and some individuals would thrive maybe in a mega lab where they don't need to see their PI, they're self-driven. But for me, what I really loved about my mentorship, mentee experience is that I was able to really connect with my mentors at all levels. And I was really lucky that way. And if I had to do it over again, I would make that choice the same. A lot of others I would do differently, but that choice I would make again, and I would advise others to really consider at every walk in life. You know, you're going to work with people, not for anybody.
Awesome. I'm going to bring it back to something that Nika mentioned right at the beginning, and to be able to focus on your communication skills. And I know for me, knowing, you know, having some writing skills, having some speaking skills really carried me through a lot of times when I didn't have the other skills that maybe I needed. And I think moving into an industry job, if you can, you know, start by writing correctly, good grammar, good, you know, sentence structure, punctuation, all of those really basic things, but moving into being able to have like a little bit of flair, a little bit of, you know, cadence and flow, and something that really makes it memorable and shows that you can articulate an idea and articulate a vision is really key. And then the ability to do that orally as well. So whether it's in front of a defense committee or, you know, formally speaking in a presentation environment at a conference, whatever it is, or just in a meeting and you're at a round table and you want to voice your perspective, being able to articulate yourself and your ideas. I'm saying this and I feel very inarticulate as I say it, but I think those are really key things, because people will not remember you, or they won't at least have a good impression of you if you can't do that. And I've seen it tragically again and again, where I know that somebody is brilliant and somebody has a really great value to add, and they can't do it themselves because they haven't developed those skills, and it's really unfortunate. So focusing on those, I think, is my biggest point.
We're all storytellers, right?
Yeah. Yep. Fortunately, you got to sell sometimes, not just because, you know, you got to get the grant, but knowing something is true in your heart and believing it with every grain, all your fabric is one thing, but you got to get other people to buy in, right? And your passion isn't always enough if you can't convey that passion in a way that's lucid and not just raving.
Yeah, exactly. Being concise and precise, as well as being yourself and having an ability to add your own little, you know, personality to that. Any final thoughts, Nika? Anything else you want to share that we didn't get to in the questions on mentorship?
I guess, I don't think there is an end goal. There's no end point to this journey of kind of mentoring. It's a thing that we always should do because it's a fun endeavor, but it also is the best way I've seen myself grow. It's really nice to learn when you get to the point where you're learning from people you would consider as mentees and you realize like they're your mentors in some ways too. That was a huge change in my perspective that I've come to appreciate. It's a really multi-directional learning opportunity. And so take all of the opportunities to be a mentor and a mentee and you will grow. Like it will be really important for you.
Amazing. Daylon, anything to add?
Yeah, same thing. Same exact thing is that, you know, you're a mentee. I'm a mentee. I have a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old, and that has really humbled me in terms of relevance, you know? I think in science, it's very similar. It's a similar idea is that you never want to be past peak relevance. And one way to safeguard against that is to keep these mentors who look up to you in your life to keep you relevant and to really be the engine of the work. And like to that point, the idea of having them realize your ideas is less important than I think giving them the framework of your ideas and letting them realize their ideas so that they can give you new ideas. And I think that's what's lost in some of these mentorship mentee relationships. It's the idea that it's unidirectional is ludicrous. And anyone who's ever served as a mentor will tell you that they gained as much, if not more, than they gave.
Daylon, you and I both have 10-year-olds and 14-year-olds, so I think we should do an entire episode on parenting teenagers, because that's one that I am not feeling as equipped to do at this point.
Exactly. I cannot answer any questions to that regard, nor give any advice.
No. That brings us to the end of our show. Don't forget to sign up for our email list at www.labcoatsandlifepodcast.com to get show notes, episode summaries, and links to useful information. Or learn more about STEM mentorship via the resources found at www.stemcell.com/labcoatsandlife. You can also reach out to us on Twitter via StemCell at StemCellTech or via email at info@labcoatsandlifepodcast.com with feedback or to suggest guests.